will you tell me how you got the name Dizzy?
Yes, I put my Spitfire into a flat spin when I was a newly joined pilot on my squadron, which is an impossible thing to do, and it's even more impossible to get out of. And the news got round, and I was called Dizzy.
You're talking about jargon. I mean, that's another bit of jargon, presumably at that time, you go into a flat spin.
Well, yeah, I think modern aircraft don't go in flat spins, but I wouldn't say jargon. It was true. It did happen. A spin is a vertical thing, but a flat spin is going round like that and descending, you know, like an autumn leaf.
Yeah. The other thing was the top button thing from fighter command, or fighter pilots having the top button undone. How did that come about? Do you know how that...
Yes, we wanted to be distinctive. We thought nothing of bomber command or any of the other commands in the Air Force, and we were rather rebellious people. So we broke uniform regulations and undid our top button.
You've actually very graphically described at one point your thoughts on waking. You got called in the morning by Batman, I believe. And what happened? Can you just recall a sort of morning? Were the curtains, did the curtains get pulled back, and then what did you think?
Well, you had blackouts on your windows, and you lived in a wooden shed normally. We officers had their Batman at that time. My Batman's main duty was to look after my dog. But he'd wake me up at some ungodly hour in the morning, 3:30, depending on the time of year, and double summertime. And he'd give me a cup of rather nasty tea. And then he'd just look after my dog for the rest of the day until I got back at night, because I was flying.
And your first thoughts when you came to consciousness in September, say?
Well, here we go again, I suppose. You know, get to readiness, go and look at your aircraft, go and talk to your mechanics, make sure your parachute was ready, your helmet was there, your gauntlets were there, do a check on the aircraft to make sure it was ready for immediate takeoff, and the engines were always kept warm, because the mechanics ran them up, because you had to be ready for an immediate takeoff. So your first reaction was, let's get ready.
Could you get up easily?
Like a absolute flash. It was automatic. One had to.
And what about the weather? Did your thoughts go to the weather?
Oh, yes, I hoped it'd be, the cloud would be on the deck, and it'd be raining so we couldn't take off. But in September, unfortunately, it was an Indian summer. So we had to take off anyway.
Now, you're talking about readiness. Passing the time in readiness, all sorts of people did all sorts of things. There's a picture of you playing chess, I think, at some point. Were you a great chess player?
Well, yes, I could beat the intelligence officer, who was an Oxford Don, so I liked playing chess with him. But you had to do something when you were hanging around waiting for the telephone to ring and order you into the air. So you played chess, and chaps played poker, and that sort of thing. You had to while away the time. A lot of waiting in war. It's not all action.
What was your poker like?
I got rather better in due course, but I lost a lot of money to start with.
Now, what summertime, double summertime. What difference did that make to the day for you? Some people didn't like it, I believe, or it made a difference to them. Did it to you?
Well, it only meant the watch had to be adjusted, really. It meant that you were up at 3:30 instead of 5:30. On the other hand, of course, the dusk came down a bit earlier, so it didn't really matter in those terms, except it was rather unusual being awoken. You had to be at readiness before first light. And first light appears nearly an hour before dawn. And I lived in that condition for 2 years, and I saw the sunrise virtually for over 2 years, almost every day. And I rather miss it now.
What about the other people in your squadron at that time? Were they sharply contrasting characters? You were all pretty young. And are young men, to other young men, sharply contrasting characters? Can you remember what sort of chaps they were?
Well, I should say that 30% of the squadron was sergeant pilots. Now, the volunteer reserve was a very good scheme, meaning that these chaps were suitable for commissions, but hadn't been commissioned, and they lived in different messes from us, but of course they did salute, but never called us sir. They were the same sort of people as we were. But you had your public school people, you had your grammar school people, and you had your secondary school people. But it was very much a community. There was no snobbery or anything like that about it all.
Did you have a car at that time?
Oh, yes. I had a 2-litre Lagonda. It was my pride and joy.
That was usual or unusual?
A number of people had cars. Not everybody. In fact, one chap had a car which he drove out on a scramble order one day, parked it discreetly, and then cut it in half with his Spitfire propeller because he failed to see it, which was quite easy to do in a Spitfire because you couldn't see much ahead. You had to swing obliquely ahead.
How did you like... Did you ever fly a Hurricane?
Oh, yes.
Can you explain to me the difference in handling between the Hurricane and the Spitfire?
No comparison. The Hurricane was a cab horse and the Spitfire was a racehorse. The Hurricane was sluggish, it was much slower, it was quite manoeuvrable. There were more Hurricane pilots who gained success in the Battle of Britain than Spitfire pilots, only because there were far more Hurricanes in fighter command at the time, and therefore there were a number of more exceptional pilots flying Hurricanes and Spitfires. But the myth about the Hurricane, and of course Hurricane pilots would disagree with me, is nonsense. There was no comparison between the two.
What about armament on the two? Were they pretty much the same?
They're both the same, 8 Brownings, very fast rate of fire, forget the 1650 a minute per gun, I think. But both our major fighters were totally... the armament was far too little against the cannon of the 109. It was a fatal error on part of the air staff not to go for the bigger .5 machine gun and hang on to the 303 Browning. We were outgunned against the Luftwaffe.
Ground staff, before we leave that sort of waiting period, do you remember any of your ground staff? Were they, again, characters, men you could remember?
Vividly. They were marvellous chaps. My personal rigger and engine fitter, I remember quite vividly. These NCOs were incredibly good. And they worked longer hours than we did. But they never complained. No, they never went on strike. They were extraordinarily good. I couldn't speak too highly of them.
Did you ever listen to the radio at that time? Do you remember anything about the radio? Or were you very much an integrated group of people that depended not so much on outside entertainment or outside things?
I personally can't remember listening to the radio. I think some people did. But outside entertainment, at the Chatham Empire, we went there one night, and there was a veil dancer, and she intended to remove 6 of her 7 veils, and I was in the wings, so I removed the 7th. which brought the house down because she wasn't even wearing a G-string. I used it as a flying scarf.
How on earth did you just happen to be in the wings of the Chatham Empire?
Well, I wanted to get her seven failed, you see.
It was a planned operation.
Oh, yes, oh, very much so, yes.
What about the WAFs? I mean, did you see much of the WAFs on the station, or did you tend to make girlfriends outside?
Never had a girlfriend in 1940. We didn't have time. Of course, I found them later. But WAFs, over the telephone, perhaps to the operations room, one talked to them. But there were no women in our lives. We were monks. We lived in a monastic society. Believe it or not.
Difficult to believe.
Well, there was no time.
Yeah. So, there was no time away from flying and waiting. That was the main operation.
What hardly
after
ever.
After dark.
Well, we'd go to the pubs, and as I said, we'd go to the Chatham Empire occasionally from Gravesend, where I was stationed for 55 days in what I call the hot seat time of the Battle of Britain. Later, afterwards, when the weather deteriorated in October and November, we used to go to London a lot in convoy, but at that particular time in September, we really didn't leave the station. It was too late and we were too tired. It's very tiring, you know, if you're flying five or perhaps six sorties a day at 30,000 feet in unpressurized aircraft, breathing pure oxygen and looking out for Germans, you became, even though one was young and fit, you became quite exhausted.
Did that tell in other ways? I mean, did you begin to become quarrelsome amongst each other?
No, I don't think so. Where it did tell was in terms of what I call aero medicine. Everyone was frightened, of course. Very few people admitted it. But the fear before takeoff, it relaxed on takeoff. But the waiting caused fear, and it hit you in the solar plexus and in the nervous system, the center of the nervous system. And I've had a bad tummy for years. It's better now, but it took 30 years, I think, to recover.
How did it affect other people? Do you remember?
Well, you could tell people where the strain was getting too great, chain smoking, walking round the pilot's hut rapidly. Twitching. Some people had tics going on their face. You could pick them out. Most people camouflaged this fear. But if anyone told me that they were unfearful at the height of the Battle of Britain, then I wouldn't believe them.
Looking for an enemy in the sky, once you were airborne, what's that sort of feeling like?
Well, the main thing was the sun, and the Germans made good use of the sun because they had the initiative, and they tried to mount their operation with the sun behind them. So you had to peer. If you peered into the sun, it affected your eyes. I wore tinted goggles, which weren't adequate, but better than the RAF issue. And I used to bank my wing tip to just cover the sun, which left a sort of halo, which helped. But if they were up sun of you, they had the jump on you, and as for searching the skies, looking for black dots, which materialize quite sharply into hordes of bombers and fighters, I was slightly short-sighted, was a horrible business. You had to see them before they saw you, and they normally saw us before we saw them, if you see what I mean.
Is that another stomach-turning moment when you realise that the dot materialises into a formation or a squadron or the bombers or what?
Well, then you better had to get down to business, and depending on the way they were approaching or the way you were approaching, you know, well, the tactics had to be decided on the spur of the moment accordingly, and either you were lucky or you weren't. And in any case, they used to have their fighter screen going well above the main formations, so they still had the jump on you. Tactically, we were hopelessly outmaneuvered.
How, tell me about ground control. Adequate, helpful, useful?
Well, in my view, and I'm a rather controversial chap in these terms, far too much has been made of radar. Because, you see, radar only operated out to sea, and our main interceptions took place over land, and they were in the hands of the Royal Observer Corps. They were a tremendous bunch of men and women, and their sightings were far more accurate than those of radar. The controlling in general was, I think, pretty poor, which is an unconventional view, I know, but it's true, in my opinion, anyway.
Can you spell it out a bit more for somebody like myself who doesn't quite understand why you would say it was poor, on what count?
Well, you... The altitude of the raid could be easily 10,000 feet wrong by radar because of the ionosphere and technical words like that. And if you were told to patrol at 20,000 feet and the raid was at 30,000 feet, then you're wasting your time. But the Royal Observer Corps had a triangulator device, and they could gauge, providing there was no cloud, they could gauge the height of the raids very accurately. But what, in effect, happened with radar is that, on average, the controller would believe that he was spot on in putting us onto the raid. On average, he was 20 miles out. Well, you can't see more than a mile or so at high altitude, where there's no frame of reference. But the controllers used to curse us because their well-planned interception never came off, and we used to curse them because we never saw a thing. You see, according to my pilot's logbook, on 50% of the times I went off on a battle climb, we saw nothing.
Let's go on with this just a bit more into the grounds of strategy, or the overall strategy. Did you ever see the commanders of 11 or 12 group, and were you aware of any controversy between them at the time?
I never saw Lord Dowding. I don't think he ever visited any of his fighter stations, which of course was a tremendous omission, because the role of a commander is to go and see his troops, so to speak. He was busy with his office work, quite the wrong way around. Sir Keith Park came to us once, who was in command of 11 Group, and when he left, we frankly laughed. The Secretary of State for Sir Archibald Sinclair came to see us once, with his posse of civil servants and hierarchy. And when he left, we lay on the floor and giggled our heads off, because it was pathetic. I don't want to reflect against his memory, but he had no leadership whatsoever. He was just a typical not very good politician. He had nothing to do with us.
And was that what you felt about Park as well?
Park won the Battle of Britain, if anyone won the Battle of Britain. He was very much in the hot seat, and Lee Mallory in 12 Group, who made a great song and dance about his role, was totally inept when compared with Park. I think the handling of Park after the Battle of Britain, when he was removed from command of 11 Group, and for that matter Dowding, was scandalous, quite scandalous.
What about the figures? An enormous amount of people, as you've said, qualified as fighters in the Battle of Britain, but the figures and the dates give, when looked at in the way that you've done, give a different story. How many people were actually fighting day by day in the Battle of Britain?
Well, you see, in the first place, they've got the Battle of Britain wrong, because they enclosed it between the 10th of July and the 31st of October, whereas in fact it began over Dunkirk in May, and it ended effectively on the 15th of September 1940. A great number of pilots and aircrew could claim to have done even just one operation within that time scale. Well, one operation, you know, wasn't anything too much. But the statistics of the Battle of Britain will never be resolved. What I can say is, in effect, that 300 pilots, no more, were effective, and that only 17 pilots, if you can believe this, 17 pilots shot down 221 aircraft. So those 17 were aces, obviously, and the highest scoring claimant was a Czech flying officer. No, he wasn't. He was a sergeant pilot, Franciszek. And another high scoring claimant was a Pole, flying officer Vanowitz. There were Britons and other people who beat Vanowitz, but no one beat Franciszek. And they were trained in Central European Air Forces, not in the Royal Air Force.
Are you trying to make a point about our training?
Yes, I am. I think our training was totally and wholly inadequate. I think that the majority of pilots in the Battle of Britain who can claim to have been in the Battle of Britain, and quite rightly within the timescale, could hardly ride a bicycle.
Is this why some of the younger ones who came in as the battle hotted up rarely lasted? How many sorties could they last, do you think?
Well, I mean, they were lucky to get away with six. And others were, you know, they had the natural reflexes, and they lasted, and they did well. But, I mean, I was a pre-war RAF pilot. These chaps were war-trained, so I had a higher standard of training than them, but even my own training was totally inadequate. Theirs was grossly inadequate.
I think you also somewhere made a point about RT. Did you ever fly a sortie and lose RT contact? I gather that wasn't at all uncommon. Can you just enlarge on that for me?
I don't remember losing RT contact, apart from the time when I was shot up by a German aircraft and they bust my RT set. It didn't matter too much, because the system of homing control for pilots in distress was terribly poor, so you had to find your own way back anyway. But I don't remember any technical, you know, RT failure of any note.
Did you ever fight in anger?
No. I suppose one never thought of the men in the German machine, the aircraft, one thought of the aircraft. And if a bomber blew up under your fire and four men went to their death, it never occurred to one. I got a bit angry once or twice when I was shot up. But on the other hand, if he hadn't shot me up, I'd have shot him up. So it was fair dues. I do remember one occasion when there was a lone Messerschmitt 109 about the area of Chatham, and my section was vectored onto it, and I shot him down with a 30-second burst, which, even less than that, I just was lucky. His engine went on fire, and he bailed out. And then I beat him up on the end of his parachute. I passed 10 feet under his legs. I didn't shoot my guns at him or anything like that. I just wanted to put the wind up him. Then I left because I didn't give a damn where he was going to land, because obviously the army and the Home Guard and heaven knows who would have seen him coming down anyway. But I did want to put the wind up him. Not in anger, more of a joke.
What about the reverse? Because you bailed out as well. Did you ever feel that the Germans, or did you know that the Germans would try and shoot you?
They did. There's proof of that. They did shoot. And I don't know about the British. Maybe, for all I know, the British pilots might have done the same. I wouldn't know about that. But I do know the Germans did shoot pilots on the end of parachutes. Where I got really very angry was when one of my pilots collided with me. It was his fault. And he went to his doom. And I managed to bail out. When I saw his aircraft hit the ground and explode, I'd never said a prayer for him. I was very angry, because he'd broken up my Spitfire and lost his own Spitfire. We're short of Spitfires. So, okay, I was angry then, but that was one of my own fellow countrymen, not a German.
Was this uncommon to find somebody, to find planes colliding? I mean, it must have been, in a dogfight, it must have been fairly difficult to avoid colliding with other planes at some time.
Well, these days, in the civil airlines, they call a near miss 2 miles. In our day, I remember that my squadron commander, who retired as Air Commodore Lee, very gallant man, I may say, climbed the squadron through the middle of 300 German bombers, and I saw the bomb aimer lying in the nose of the Heinkel. I saw two Messerschmitt 109s pass me by yards, and yet I never had a mid-air collision with a German. How one got away, or they got away, or when anyone got away, when airline pilots say 2 miles is a near miss, and we were literally within yards of each other. To me, it's quite extraordinary.
How vivid are those memories now?
Very, very.
You can see it as you talk.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Is this period in your life more vivid than other periods?
Yes, most certainly.
Why is that?
Sentiment, I think. Of course, you know, there was a big build-up about the Battle of Britain. It's been, in my view, over-glamorized. It was a fairly severe campaign, but you could think of worse ones. But I suppose it was a battle over British soil, and we hadn't had one since 1066, or when the Spanish invaded Cornwall just before the Armada or something like that. So I suppose the sentiment. And I suppose the Churchill's propaganda and his great rhetoric about the few was good stuff. I suppose it helped the morale of the poor old British civilian who was being bombed out of his life. But I'm not convinced that the thing was as much as it's ever been made out to be, frankly. One hardly ever ate. If you wanted to have breakfast, and who wants to have sausage and egg and then breathe oxygen at 30,000 feet? Food at least I, anyway, ate very little indeed. We never had problems with catering in those terms, except the fact that you might be sitting down to eat, and then you were scrambled. So you had to go. So you left your food. What a waste.
But you weren't asking for meals at difficult times for the catering staff?
Well, yes, I'm sure we were, because breakfast formally would be probably at 4 o'clock in the morning, which would be harder than the catering staff, but they didn't mind. It was their job, and it was our job, so, you know.
No problems there. You were posted missing 3 times, I think you said.
Yes, I was wounded 4 times. I bailed out once. I crash-landed about 6 times. But I got more of them than they got me, so the sheer economics of the thing, the military economics, I reckon I won on the deal.
What about when you bailed out? There seems to be a natural reluctance to trust yourself so much to the elements as a parachute.
Well, I had no alternative, but it was a very odd experience because it happened all very quickly, as you can imagine, when a chap collides with you in mid-air. And so I just stood on the seat and the wind blew me out. I was doing 250 miles an hour, so the wind was 250 miles an hour, and it's a fair old hurricane. But going down, you never seemed to move. You were hung in mid-air. You were stationary between heaven and hell. In fact, I was just about over East Grinstead, and the whole town was watching me because they had nothing better to do because it was a Sunday and the pubs weren't open yet. And I finished up at the end of a tree.
But there's more to it than that, because you were then met.
I was met by a posse of home guard with pitchforks, and one of them had a shotgun pointed at my head. I managed to scramble down the tree and fell with a resounding thump from about 10 feet. And the old man said, "Donner and Blitzen," to me. And I said, "Shove off, you stupid old you-know-what." And he said, "God, this one's an Englishman, isn't he?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm English." And so eventually, I got a car and was driven back to my station. But it was really very funny, these old men. They would have stuck their pitchfork in me, too, if they thought I was a German, I reckon.
None of your pilots ever met, bailed out and met with a hostile reception, did they? Couldn't identify themselves quick enough?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Courage. What sort of courage does it take to fly sortie after sortie in the conditions of that September?
Well, I don't think it takes courage. I think that you just obey orders. You're trained for the job, or some of you were, and if the telephone goes and the order is scrambled, you automatically run out and take off into the sky blue yonder and hope. If you've got any sense, you say a prayer when you're taxiing out. Most of our chaps did, I believe. I certainly did. But when you're in the air, you get relaxed because the tension is on the ground. But in the air, then you've got a job to do. So you ease up and it becomes sort of automatic until you meet the raid or you miss it, whether the control is good or bad or whatever.
Is that a different sort of grit than, say, the moral courage that you might need, or the mental courage that you might need to resist, say, brainwashing or something like that? Have you any knowledge of that sort of courage?
Oh, Lord, yes. I believe that is a sort of, if you call it courage, it's an automatic courage, whereas the special operations executive people who were dropped in France, it was a cold-blooded courage because they were spies. So were the pilots who flew them out there. And had they been captured by the Gestapo, it would have been a very different set of circumstances than from being a prisoner of war as a fighter pilot. Oh, yes, I think that it's either a cold-blooded courage or it's what you might call an automatic courage.
What about loss of people in your squadron? How did you cope with that?
Well, without being too sort of brutal, one got rather used to it. I mean, I could see the look of death on faces of a number of pilots, and for all I know, they might have seen the look of death on my face. But I was usually right. Either they were killed, or they were pretty badly wounded, or injured, or burnt, or something. I lost, certainly, my best friend in August 1940, and I went to his funeral to assist in the burial. I lost a flight commander. He wasn't my flight commander, but he was a very expert pilot and a very fine pianist. And his death hit me very hard indeed. I wonder why, but it did. It seemed to me he was indestructible, and it turned out that he wasn't.
You say it hit you hard. In what way? Did you become introspective, or did it affect your performance? How?
No, it was a momentary sadness, which my squadron commander noted, and in fact, the flight commander I'm referring to was his best friend. But my squadron commander saw that I was sort of, if you like, disintegrating in terms of morale because of this, and he was very sharp with me and pulled me together. But of course it hit him harder than it hit me, but he was a bigger man than I, and he could concede it. He had to.
Were the friendships that you and other people made at that time, I mean, you were very much together, were they special friendships in the sense that they lasted a great deal of time? Were they? What sort of friendships came out of that period, to your knowledge?
Well, apart from one's dead friends, who one's certainly not forgotten, but, you know, they're no longer friends, my best friend is my first squadron commander, Rupert Lee. And he and I have been in touch now for nearly 40 years. And there's a certain affinity, very difficult to explain. The only explanation you can really come to is that we were comrades in arms, because I always used to fly on his wing. So we were in action together. Literally, you know, he and I, although he had the squadron to lead, but the squadron always got broken up. So there's a very special relationship there, which is difficult to define.
And you saw this happen in other groups as well, presumably? Other fighting groups?
Not particularly. I wouldn't know, honestly. I wouldn't have thought that great friendships were necessarily struck up in that period.
Talked a little bit about courage. Now, what about cowardice? Did it occur?
Oh, Lord, yes. Difficult to prove. I can prove one case. A newly joined sergeant pilot in my squadron, who I was leading the squadron, and I worked out on the ground that he was a coward anyway. You can tell him. And he lost formation, which is always a convenient thing to do, and I called him on the RT and said, "Rejoin, we're climbing into the sun, and if you're not with me in 2 minutes, I'll have you court-martialed." If he hadn't joined up, I'd have found him and I'd have shot him, And I wouldn't have been accused of murder, because I would have said it was a Messerschmitt 109, I thought, because in those days it was very difficult to identify aircraft in any sort of dogfight. But I'd have shot him.
Is that the... What sort of emotion is that? Is that simply an absolute necessity because of keeping a group together?
It was anger in my case, because I diagnosed him on the ground and he did exactly what I thought he'd do, and he did a bunk. And as I say, I'd have shot him. Period. It wouldn't have been a difficult target.
What is it then about a man that you can? You said you diagnosed him on the ground. You said that you could tell a coward. What is it?
Well, it's experience, I suppose. When you're dealing with men in those sort of circumstances, be they officers or be they sergeants, and action is pending any time of the day, you get a feel, a sort of instinct. You become a psychiatrist or a psychologist or something like that. I could pick them out a mile away, and there were quite a number of cowards in 1940. I suppose it's human nature.
Did you try and get rid of them before they flew?
I got rid of one, which was later on in 1941. I tried him out. I knew he was a coward, and I checked him out and got my flight commander to check him out and prove that he was a coward by devious means. Then I sent him off on a medical confidential chit, asserting that this man lacked moral fibre, as we used to say. 9 months later, the psychiatrist confirmed my impression, which took me 5 seconds to assess. So, you know, who's best, the chap on the ground or the doctor in the laboratory or in surgery or something?
You've said to me that the leadership came from the squadron leaders at that time. Is that what really got us through?
Yes, most certainly. The total leadership in the Battle of Britain came from the squadron leaders, not all of them, let's get that straight. Most of them, the flight commanders and the section leaders. And there were, I should think, total 300 of those. So, in effect, 300 leaders of that kind were responsible for the outcome. There was an awful lot of ullage among the newly joined pilots, not their fault, they were undertrained, and so on, or they should say the sediment. But either you were lucky or you were dead.
Can you recall some of the amusing moments on the ground or in the air?
I remember the our squadron intelligence officer, who was an Oxford Don, the air raid sirens went, and he was in a bath, and he came rushing down and jumped into an air raid shelter, whereupon we pulled him out. He had a tin hurt in his head, but nothing else. We pulled him out of the air raid shelter, painted him with gentian violet in, you know, the sort of male area, and then took him out of the middle of the airfield and made him run home. But things like that went on, you know.
Yes, things like that kept you going, I should think, yes.
Well, they were a relief, weren't they?
Is that when you or anybody else first started drinking? Or I don't mean to say that drinking in the sense of drinking heavily, but was that a lot at a time when a lot of young men first started drinking?
I don't believe that. I certainly didn't drink or smoke at the time, but there was no tremendous drinking. I always carried a flask of brandy in my flying overall pocket, and I did empty it on one occasion when I was shot down and landed in a heap. But, you know, I had no head for drink anyway, so they thought I'd crash because I was drunk. But no, I wouldn't say there was much drinking. In the old Royal Flying Corps, you know, they used to say they were a drunken lot. But a lot of reputable people, such as, for example, Lord Balfour of Inchrie, would deny that there was heavy drinking. He said that they drank a little, and they were so pitched and tensed that a little drink went a long way. And I don't remember any cases in 1940 of any form of drunkenness whatsoever.